From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is the U.S. leading the way to a global recession? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The International Monetary Fund says America's financial crisis is so bad it'll damage the rest of the world, except for the Middle East and Asia. This as finance ministers from the major industrialized countries have gathered in Washington to figure out what to do. Not everybody's as pessimistic as the IMF, but nobody doubts there's trouble ahead. On To the Point, is the global economy faced with another Great Depression? How worried should Americans be? What should be done? And will there be winners as well as losers, both at home and abroad? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The globalized economy means that America's financial problems could spread to the rest of the world. The International Monetary Fund says there's a 1 in 4 chance of a global recession, as finance ministers are meeting in Washington to decide what to do. On To the Point, how closely linked are the world's economies? Will there be winners as well as losers? Should Americans be worried? First, this news update. The opposition to Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has called for a general strike starting on Tuesday. Mugabe says he won't attend a much-awaited summit with other African leaders. He's banned all political rallies, and human rights groups report he has launched a campaign of systematic violence. Craig Timberg is Johannesburg bureau chief for The Washington Post, just home in South Africa after 3 weeks in Zimbabwe. Craig Timberg, thanks very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
What was it like for you and other reporters in Zimbabwe?
It was the most difficult reporting I've ever done. I mean, there was a lot of misinformation. Getting clear facts was really hard. And, you know, we all had to be careful because the Zimbabwean government has basically illegalized us being there. So it was scary.
Reporters have been arrested. Did you come close to that yourself?
Much closer than I want to tell you, or that I want to tell my wife.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. What did you see? And particularly, are there outbreaks of violence, or were there while you were there?
Yeah. I mean, the idea that this election was peaceful is really overblown. It was only peaceful by the standards of recent Zimbabwean elections. There's people getting beat up and threatened, essentially, as we speak. I interviewed a 64-year-old grandfather who was an opposition activist the other day, and he took out a white shirt from his cupboard that was covered in blood. He had been beaten up so badly just a few weeks ago. It was amazing.
And what is the reaction of the opposition going to mean if, in fact, they try to hold a general strike?
You know, the history of strikes and mass action in Zimbabwe is not at all impressive. In a place where, at best, 20% of people have formal jobs, you know, a strike doesn't necessarily make all that much difference. And they have no track record whatsoever of turning out people on the streets in large numbers.
What was expected or is expected now at the summit meeting that Robert Mugabe says he's not going to attend?
You know, it's not 100% clear that he's not going to attend. What's happened is that the state radio, which is, you know, a government organ, listed three people who are going to attend and didn't list the president. So I don't know. I think that it's not totally clear yet. But the idea is that the Southern Africa regional leaders are going to get together and try to sort this out. It's not the first time they've tried to do so. But for Zimbabweans, it's an incredibly crucial meeting because it's seen that those leaders are the ones who are seen that can actually make a difference.
Make a difference in what way?
Well, that's exactly the right question. I mean, Mugabe has depended, you know, he's very critical of Britain and the United States, and they're critical back, but he's always had sort of at least that, you know, the appearance of support of his neighbors. And if that really turned, if South Africa and Zambia and Botswana, et cetera, started criticizing him publicly, it would clearly weaken his position in his country to an enormous extent.
And what would that mean? Would there then be resistance to the violence, or would he have to call it off, or what immediate results would we see?
It's impossible to know. I mean, every time my journalist friends and I get together and try to predict what's going to happen in Zimbabwe, we're always wrong. But I can tell you that in the immediate aftermath of the election, when it was clear that he lost the first round, that a lot of people within the ruling party came to him and said, it's really time to go. Now, the military and the police and the security services generally seem to be his key bulwark. support now. But it's all based on the premise that, you know, it's in some ways, you have to wonder if it's not a paper tiger. If people really pushed hard, would it make a difference? If people in the ruling party and the military lost faith in the idea that Mugabe will always be in charge, you just don't know what would happen.
We're talking with Craig Timberg, Johannesburg bureau chief of the Washington Post. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, you mentioned that he lost the first round. The opposition leader, Tsvangirai, is claiming that he actually won outright. What's happening to him, and is he at risk?
Look, he's not in Zimbabwe right now, so he's not in imminent risk. But look, every single member of the opposition is at risk essentially every minute they're in Zimbabwe. So, he's at risk. They charged him with treason, which is a capital crime, just a few years ago. And so he's, in some ways, he's lucky to be alive even now.
So if Mugabe's own supporters appear to be somewhat divided, that would suggest then that the loss of regional support might make a big difference in that, right within his own coterie.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable kind of piece of logic. They were very there was a lot of problems the first few days. As of about a week ago, they kind of got themselves together, and they've really taken the initiative back from the opposition over the past week. So I don't know exactly what would happen if the regional leaders suddenly talked out, but it seems to be about the only thing that has the prospect of breaking the logjam there.
And very quickly, the neighbors are concerned about refugees from Zimbabwe.
They're concerned about refugees. They're concerned about their region looking like a troubled region as opposed to a basically successful and prosperous region, which it is. And I believe they believe in some idea of democracy reigning in their part of the world. I don't think they want to see Zimbabwe be what it's been for the past 8 years.
Well, Craig Timberg in Johannesburg for The Washington Post, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
On Reporter's Notebook later on, pirates captured after releasing 30 hostages. In a moment, is the U.S. leading the way to a global recession? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The financial market crisis that erupted in August 2007 has developed into the largest financial shock since the Great Depression. That's a quote from the latest economic forecast by the International Monetary Fund. The IMF predicts that the U.S. will experience a mild recession, but it also says there's a 1 in 4 chance that America's problems will produce a global recession. Simon Johnson is chief economist for the International Monetary Fund, and thank you very much for being with us. Simon Johnson, are you with us?
This is Simon Johnson.
Thank you very much for joining us. How is it that the economies of so many countries are so interconnected that you think the American financial crisis could produce a global recession?
Well, we've obviously been working long and hard on globalization of trade and to a lesser degree, finance. And as a result, we've had a very good run of global growth. It's absolutely about the creation of a global economy. But it has also created these interconnections. Now we have a serious issue in the U.S. with housing and with consumption. I'm afraid that's spilling over to pretty much every country in the world.
How does it work? How do America's problems with housing and consumption affect the rest of the world?
Well, it works in two main ways. First of all, through finance. As we've learned, there's a lot of exposure outside the United States to U.S. housing, either directly or indirectly. And that's a big problem for industrial countries, for example, in Europe. Secondly, there's a very traditional mechanism, which is through trade. So as the U.S. slows down and as other industrial countries slow down, they buy less goods from other places, including from middle-income emerging markets. And that, in turn, is going to have spillover effects on commodity prices and so on, and that's the way everybody gets involved.
And that exposure you're talking about is due to the fact that subprime mortgages were lumped together, made into what were referred to, or what I have heard called, ignorant as I am of economic affairs, financial instruments that were then invested in by people all over the world.
That's right. The sometimes this is called securitization. Mortgages were exactly put together and packaged in ways that people thought made them less risky and spread the risk within the package, and then were sold in various ways, maybe even split up and sold. in ways that people thought further spread the risk. It turned out it didn't spread the risk. It actually concentrated the risk at the core of the financial system in the United States, in some European countries, and elsewhere in the industrial world. This was a very big misunderstanding and mistake made largely by the private sector, and it's that we're now having to deal with on a global scale.
In your report, you made that comparison to the Great Depression. What's the same and what's different since then?
Well, we said we weren't saying it's the same as the Great Depression. We're saying that since the Great Depression, we've not really encountered a problem with the core global financial system of this scale. So, and that's partly a testament to the stability of the post-war period. But you know, while there were problems in the U.S., for example, the savings and loans in the 1980s and so on, and there were individual banks that failed, we've never had the kind of pressure, prolonged pressure, on the core of the U.S. and the core of the industrial country financial system that we've seen over the past 9 months. It's not unprecedented, but we have to go back quite far and to some fairly dramatic historical events to find a parallel.
And how do you define the core?
The core would be major banks, both. Of course, we use the word banks in the United States to mean commercial banks and investment banks. In many other countries, commercial banks and investment banks are the same banks. But basically, that distinction is a little bit less relevant in the U.S. right now. All, you know, major banks, one way or another, almost all, have got caught up in this. Almost all of them have suffered problems or serious problems with their risk management systems. And, you know, it's very hard to find exceptions to that among, you know, major banks based in New York or doing business around the country and so on and so forth. I'm sure some small savings banks have managed to stay out of it, and credit unions and so on. But the big banks of the U.S. and a number of other countries are very much involved.
There's a report out today that consumer confidence in the United States is at a new low. What should Americans worry about most?
Well, you're right. This is the Michigan Index, University of Michigan Index of Consumer Sentiment. I think it's the lowest since 1982, if I'm not mistaken. I think consumer confidence, if we're talking about the macroeconomic level, consumer confidence is absolutely key. The U.S. consumer has been resilient in previous downturns and has led us to quicker recoveries than other countries have experienced. And so it's really what happens at the consumer level that is going to make a difference. And consumers are obviously very worried about house prices. Now, obviously, for the United States, it's a very big country. There's a lot of regional variation. And I wouldn't want people to get too focused on the national prices. I think what matters is what's happening in people's localities. And we are seeing prices turn around in some places. Hopefully, this becomes a more general phenomenon. But what happens to house prices is clearly a key concern.
Again, Simon Johnson is chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. David Malpass is a chief economist at Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns, of course, almost collapsed, was bought out by J.P. Morgan Chase in a deal guaranteed by the Federal Reserve. David Malpass, good to have you with us.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Again, your company almost collapsed, had to be bailed out, but you are still bullish. And I want to know in what ways you disagree with Simon Johnson at the IMF.
I think a lot of his points were interesting. So I guess the focus that I'm looking at is this consumer resilience issue for the next few quarters. Now, it's true that in August of last year, the financial turbulence had a huge drag on the U.S. and global growth. And that's what a lot of the data is showing that's coming in now. But as we look forward, the Fed has lowered interest rates much more than in normal slowdowns. That, I think, is going to translate or be helpful to the consumer. Also, on the side of the consumer is the pass-through from as inventories begin to build for companies. There will be better deals on things like cars, and we're already seeing that in houses with prices coming down. So one of the issues for the next few quarters is whether the low consumer confidence actually translates into low sales. We've had frequent occasions in the past when they don't match, meaning people can lose confidence in the economy as a whole, but if their own situations are reasonably good, they go ahead and consume. And that would change people's outlook a bit if they saw that.
There would be less money involved, though, would there not?
That's not as clear. People's consumption is most closely tied with their perception of future income growth. In many ways, credit gets overplayed in terms of its impact on GDP or on consumption. The critical thing is company profits, which then creates jobs. And if that mechanism is still functioning, which it is so far, then that can lead to the resilience or support the resilience that we've been used to in the past.
So how do you react to the IMF saying there's a 1 in 4 chance that America's problems will produce a global recession?
Now, I'm not sure I disagree with that. If the U.S. has a recession, a 1 in 4 chance is not such a high. You know, if they said there was a 75% chance, you could question. But 1 in 4 sounds plausible. We are dealing, after all, with probabilities, meaning what is the chance that people's opinion of the auto and the housing market turns more upbeat as the prices come down. If you ask people, would you consider buying a car if there's a big rebate involved, you're probably going to get a more optimistic answer than what they've been used to in recent months with the lack of or with the higher prices being offered.
Well, what about housing prices? Back to Simon Johnson said a moment ago that was going to be key. Will the prices of homes drop far enough that people will be able to afford them?
They've already come down, and that is showing up in the affordability data. And so there's two ways to look at that. Some potential buyers will say, let's wait until they get even cheaper. And others will say, hey, this looks like a pretty good deal. And it's very hard to find the psychology or to track when it converts from more of a buyer's market into more of a balanced market. That is somewhat sensitive to mortgage rates. So one of the key variables to look at is just if mortgage rates come down some, which I think they may do, then that helps the affordability.
David Malpass, again, chief economist at Bear Stearns. Let me get a couple of other voices into this program, then we'll go back and talk about what our various guests think ought to be done. Desmond Lochman is a former chief emerging market economist at Solomon Smith Barney in New York. He's now resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He worked at the International Monetary Fund through the mid-90s. Desmond Lochman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You have apparently indicated that you think prospects are even worse than the IMF does. Why?
Well, there are a variety of reasons. You know, partly I agree with Simon Johnson. You know, I think that he's identifying what is the key problem, which is the largest housing bust since the Great Depression. And what we're seeing is, if we look at the national level, we're seeing house prices falling by 10%, and there's every prospect that house prices in 2008 are going to fall by a similar amount. What that does is it destroys household wealth. You know, we've already looked at something like $2.5 trillion of household wealth being destroyed, which makes households feel less comfortable about their savings, so they go out and spend less. But what's also occurred in the United States is households have been borrowing very heavily against their homes, you know, withdrawing equity from their homes through borrowing. As house prices come down, that becomes more difficult for them to do. So it's hardly surprising that we're seeing consumer confidence collapsing, retail sales all being very bad. What is also occurring that, you know, perhaps Simon could have emphasized a little bit more is the dollar's virtually in free fall, that the dollar now is at its lowest level since floating in 1973. We're just going down to record lows against the euro, that it's falling against the yen. And what that is doing is it's causing oil prices to go to very high levels. So what we're seeing is oil now at record levels, $110 a barrel. Even if we adjust for inflation, we've never had oil prices like that. And it looks like we're on our way to $3.50, $4 in terms of gasoline. So the consumer is going to be impacted by that. To make matters worse, we've got what Alan Greenspan now is calling as the most wrenching credit crunch in the past 60 years. You know, Paul Volcker, another former chairman of the Federal Reserve is describing this as the mother of all crises. So we're getting banks pulling back on their lending. I'd be very surprised if when we're subjecting the economy to so many shocks of an unusual magnitude that we don't have a recession that's very much longer than the normal recession. And it looks like that's where the indications now are clearly pointing.
Desmond Lachman again at the American Enterprise Institute. This is To the Point from PRI. So back to David DeMalpas at Bear Stearns. When you hear Desmond Lachman talk about the dollar in free fall, oil prices being high, Greenspan talking about the credit crunch, and Volcker about the mother of all crises, how can you be bullish?
Those are a lot of adjectives that sound pretty scary. I don't know that I'm bullish, but and I think Desmond correctly laid it out. Is it going to be a long recession? I think not so long. And the reasons for some hope on that side are that inventories going into this slowdown were low. Normally, a recession is caused when inventories are high, when companies have been spending a lot of money on business investment, as in 1999 and 2000. Remember, the dot-com bubble of those years was huge amounts of money being put into fiber optics and other things like that, and also when companies have hired a lot of people and really ballooned up their payrolls. None of those were the case this time. And then add to that that the Fed has lowered interest rates very quickly here in 2008. We don't know, or it's important to, as things get grimmer, to put them into the bigger context. Unemployment at 5% is 5.1 is relatively low by historical standards. It may go a little higher, but so far businesses are able to make profit in this environment, and that again is a critical leading indicator of slowdowns. Always in the past, to get to a real slowdown, you needed to have profits actually falling. And we haven't seen that except in the last quarter. Oftentimes, they fall four or five quarters in a row before there's a slowdown. And the reason for that is because businesses hire workers if they're making profit. So those are some responses to that.
David Malpass with Bear Stearns is still with us. Desmond Lachman at the American Enterprise Institute and Simon Johnson, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. We'll hear from them and also from Bill Emmett, the former editor of The Economist magazine, after we take a brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, we'll hear about pirates, hostages, and big money for ransom. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, once again talking about the meeting of the, or talking in the context of the meeting of the finance ministers of the industrialized world, a meeting in Washington this weekend to try to decide what to do about an American financial crisis that the International Monetary Fund says could lead to a global recession. One in four chance of that. This as American consumer confidence reaches its lowest level since 1982. And as we heard a moment ago from Desmond Lachman at the American Enterprise Institute, the dollar is in free fall. Bill Emmett is former editor of The Economist magazine. He's now an independent writer, author of the new book Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. And Bill Emmett, good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you.
What do you think about the falling dollar?
I think that that's part of the solution. It's not a great problem. What America needs is recovery in some part of its economy, and exports are that part, and a falling dollar is exactly what's required. One of the problems, though, is that it's falling only against the euro and the yen and not against other currencies more broadly, particularly the Chinese currency. At least it's not fallen very much against the Chinese currency because the Chinese are manipulating the rate. I think that really we need an adjustment between all to deal with the trade deficit that America has, to deal with the surpluses in other countries, and the dollar's fall is a good thing, but it's not happening in quite the right way.
What about the crash of Bear Stearns? Is that a good thing?
Actually, you know, Desmond Malpass may not agree with me, but I think it is. Not because I have anything against Bear Stearns, but because it represented an acceptance by the financial system, by the banking system, of the fact that there were huge losses underway. It was, if you like, the end of the period of denial that I think had been happening in the banking system. And finally, the losses were being accepted. You know, if you look back at the Japanese crisis of the 1990s, which many people hark back to and worry about whether America will have the same thing, in Japan it really took them 3 or 4 years before they accepted the magnitude of what's been happening. In America it's taken 6 months, and I think that is why I'm optimistic in the end. America is quintessentially a take-your-punches economy. It's the sort of place that takes its losses, dusts itself off, and gets going again. And I think the collapse of Bear Stearns was the beginning of those punches being taken and the adjustment happening.
Bill Emmett with The Economist, formerly with The Economist magazine. Desmond Lachman, back to you at the American Enterprise Institute. What do you say about the falling dollar being a good thing because it will encourage exports?
Well, I could agree with that in part. You know, if we get an orderly decline of the dollar, that would be a good thing. The dollar's been declining since 2002, and that is the way in which America will reduce its very large trade deficit. The fear, though, is that the decline of the dollar becomes disorderly, and the reason that that could occur is that we've got foreigners holding enormous amounts of dollars, running literally into the trillions of dollars. And what they're seeing right now is they're seeing American interest rates being reduced, and they're seeing a dysfunctional American financial system. The risk is that foreigners will begin to bail from the dollar. This is really what is worrying, has to be very worrying to the central bank. And if that is the case, we can get disruption to the financial market. I should mention, you know, just in terms of the financial market, the IMF has come out with really very good work indicating that the losses on bad lending during the past cycle could amount to as close to $1 trillion, and only something like $250 billion of that those losses have been recognized to date. So we've got a very long way to go in getting this financial system right.
Back, Bill Emmett, to the issue of the falling dollar. Maybe other investors overseas are not interested in taking punches.
Well, I think, first of all, that some of them are taking punches. Swiss banks are among the financial institutions that have taken the big losses, French banks, British banks. This is a global problem, as Simon Johnson said at the outset of the discussion. Secondly, I think the question is, these foreign central banks in particular who own huge amounts of U.S. securities, I think what we have to ask ourselves is, why would they sell with a falling dollar? Why would they decide to cause their losses to go even bigger? I'm not sure that the likelihood of a disorderly decline is all that high. I mean, it clearly exists. There is a risk. If it's like Simon Johnson's 1 in 4 chance of a global recession. We're talking about probabilities here. And most people don't try to shoot themselves in the foot. And I think that foreign central banks who own a lot of these dollars are unlikely to go in for self-inflicted wounds in of that sort.
If, as you say, the American economy takes its punches, why is it then that banks and consumers need the big bailouts?
Well, I think the banks need to take punches, and they should not need very big bailout, but we've recognized in the financial system ever since the 1860s, a great former editor of The Economist, actually, Walter Badgett, who came up with the idea that you needed to have bailouts. You needed central banks to make bailouts, but always with penalties. Someone needs to be punished. In the case of Bear Stearns, it was the shareholders who were punished, but the financial system as a whole was supported through the bailout, and that's the right principle. You need to punish certain parties, make them take losses so that they recognize the risks they took, but you mustn't let the whole financial system collapse.
Let me go back to David Malpass, the chief economist at Bear Stearns. Do you agree with Bill Emmett that it was a good thing that Bear Stearns collapsed, or almost collapsed, and had to be bailed out because it was acceptance, indication of acceptance, of the kinds of risks that were involved and the fact that there were so many losses?
I don't want to comment on that. I do think that the weaker dollar, the theme that you were running there, the weaker dollar becomes a key variable in the outlook. And so with the weakness, it's discouraging investment into the U.S. And so one of the key variables as I'm looking at the outlook for the rest of 2008 is whether the dollar begins to find a bottom here or whether the administration creates a bottom for it. The G7 is meeting this weekend. Unfortunately, it looks as if they won't be discussing or adding much context for thinking about the weakness of the dollar. And so that perpetuates this inflation concern that's really growing in the U.S.
Let me go back to our first guest, Simon Johnson, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. There has been talk that there will be more government intervention needed. I believe that's a premise of your report, not a premise of it, but rather a conclusion of it. Is that the case? And if so, who's going to win? Who's going to lose?
Well, I think it remains to be seen exactly what kind of government actions are needed going forward. We talk about three lines of defense: monetary policy, which is clearly already fully in play in the United States, and we think will continue to be called upon. And I think Europe is next up at bat in that category. Secondly, fiscal policy. Obviously, the U.S. I think has used fiscal stimulus this year. That's a major government action, and we think it's going to be timely and targeted, arriving just when it's needed in the second half. We're not advocating further discretionary fiscal stimulus. It's a very tricky thing to get timed and scaled right. So at this point, that's our view. We do think other countries around the world have some so-called fiscal space in which they can operate. But inflationary pressures, which, for example, Desmond emphasized, are a serious issue, particularly due to increasing commodity prices. So there's a delicate balance there. But I think the real heart of the government intervention is the use of the public balance sheet to support the financial system. Obviously, the Fed took some decisive action in this regard and did put public money very much to the fore in the last month or so. We think that was appropriate. We think the circumstances were really quite difficult. And we think that there should be plans not just in the United States, but much more broadly around the world, on a contingency basis, meaning you don't have to do it now, but you should think about how you would do it if called upon, if the circumstances require it, to make a sort of decisive stand, save the financial system, but save it in a way that doesn't lead to problems either in the short term in terms of bailing out the people you don't want to bail out, or longer term in terms of creating moral hazard problems. It is a very tough thing to do, and it's not something that we think about and call for at all lightly, but we think the global financial situation is precarious. We think that it is currently stabilized, but it could get worse. And if it does get worse, then governments around the world may be called upon to intervene and to use the so-called third line of defense.
Desmond Lachman, back to you with the American Enterprise Institute. Do you think that public money will be needed in the way that Simon Johnson is talking about? And if so, let me ask that question again. Will there be winners? Will there be losers?
I've got very little doubt that in the end, public money is going to be required. You know, public money has already been used in terms of the Bear Stearns bailout. There was a $29 billion loan that the Fed is putting at risk. The Fed has been buying mortgage paper, which puts its balance sheet at risk. But I think, sadly, there's a whole lot more public money that is going to have to be used in the end. And that's basically because the housing market, we had an incredible boom in housing prices. They increased by something like 80% over the past 6 years between 2000 and 2006. And now when we get the bust, we're really going to need public money in one way or another to help stabilize that economy. I think it's very useful what the IMF is doing is to very clearly diagnose what kind of situation that we're faced with, that this is not our common garden variety of recession. This is a recession caused by a housing bust, by a credit bubble bursting, by high oil prices, and we really do need to think very seriously about the kind of unorthodox policy measures that are going to be needed to stabilize the situation. One final point I'd like to make is monetary policy looks as if it's being very supportive. The Federal Reserve has indeed cut interest rates by 300 basis points since last August. But because we've got so many problems in the banking system, so many credit-related problems, the spreads on interest rates are very high, with the net result that interest rates to final borrowers today are, in general, not very different than they were at the beginning of the rate-cutting cycle last August. So monetary policy is not working. We're going to have to do a lot more if we're not going to go into a rather deep recession.
Bill Emmett, let me go back to you, former editor of The Economist magazine. You indicated that people need to be punished, and so far it's been the shareholders of Bear Stearns. What about the kinds of further expenditures of public money that Desmond Lachman is talking about? What's the impact of that? Who are the winners? Who are the losers?
Well, I think it really depends what happens. I don't think currently there is a case for bigger expenditure of public money. As was said earlier, U.S. unemployment is only just over 5%. This is a drama, but it's not yet, in my view, a crisis. Likely further rescues would come if there were bank collapses, and then I think you may well need to have public money brought in to nationalize some banks. Then, too, the shareholders would be the losers. The people who would gain from that would be the depositors who got their protection fulfilled. And hopefully the new owners of those banks when they were pushed out. There's a big debate about whether or not public money should be used directly to support borrowers in the housing market, to support ordinary Americans, particularly poorer ones who are unable to afford their mortgages. I'm against that. I think it's, first of all, a rather un-American solution to have a kind of socialization of the housing market. But also I think this market needs to be allowed to work. But in the end, if things get really, truly, humongously terrible, as per some of the forecasts we've been hearing on today's show, that might be necessary. But I think socialism, which is what it is, has to be the last resort.
Simon Johnson with the International Monetary Fund, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm not sure it's even a drama. I agree we don't have to call it a crisis. Our view is you should prepare. You should think ahead. And the best way, I think you get better bang for your public buck when you think about how you could use it, how you would use it if the situation deteriorated. So our call is not a call for action. It's a call for preparation. We don't want governments around the world to be taken by surprise. And I think we should all remember how quickly debate in the U.S. has changed. You know, Bill is absolutely right that the U.S. takes its punches and moves on, and that's true also in the public debate. But I don't think any of us in early December imagined that we would have already run through a fiscal stimulus, already be deploying significant amount of public money. I think it's very good that the U.S. Authorities have an ability to think outside the box and to move fast and move creatively. We are calling on governments around the world to reflect on that experience, to think about the implications both directly and indirectly for their own economies, and to plan ahead.
Desmond Lachman, what about the idea that the bailout is a form of socialism?
Well, there's no question that it's an unpalatable type of option, but the problem is that inaction is not viable either, you know, that is worse. So we're just choosing between the least of evils. The point is that the housing market is really showing enormous signs of stress, and there's every indication that it gets worse. Just as an indication, the last quarter of the year, house prices were falling at an annual rate of 20%. Meantime, the supply on the market is excessive. We're roughly at something like 10 months inventories. And to make matters worse, foreclosures are rising at an alarming rate. You know, some people refer to a tsunami of foreclosures that is about to hit this market. If you look at the forward prices for houses, the Schiller Case Index future market is indicating that house prices in 10 major American cities are going to be falling over the next 2 years by anywhere between 15 and 30%. This is a real crisis. This is really what has caused the economy to stall, to begin moving into a recession. And my point is that there's absolutely no indication that there's any relief on sight on the housing market. And until we address the main cause of the crisis, this crisis is really going to just deepen.
David Malpass, back to you, chief economist at Bear Stearns. Very dire prediction by Desmond Lachman.
Yes. Now, housing clearly has been a problem. I'll make several points on that. One is the housing slowdown and pressure on the economy really started in 2005. So there's been quite a bit of progression of that problem. Usually, recessions are caused by problems that are not anticipated, by cyclical problems where there's suddenly too much inventory, let's say. This problem has been around since 2005. The Case-Shiller index is a high beta index, meaning they're taking the most pricey cities in the country and plotting the decline in prices. And it should be put into the context of how big the gains were in the Case-Shiller in those same cities, meaning they ran up maybe 100%. I don't know that particular 10 city index that Desmond was referring to. And so there's some give back from the top. Another thing that's probably going to help some is that starts have fallen to such a low level. Remember, the population in the country is growing fast, and starts have fallen to 700,000 units annual rate, which is very small given the size of the population. So those are some of the things that may soften the impact over the coming quarters. The fact that we've already had a huge impact out of housing in previous years.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We will see what happens over the weekend as the finance ministers meet and whether any further action is going to be taken here in the United States. Of course, David Malpass, chief economist at Bear Stearns, Desmond Lachman with the American Enterprise Institute, Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist magazine. His recent book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade, and Simon Johnson, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Thank you all very much for being with us. This is To the Point from PRI. Piracy at sea is not some historical curiosity. It's a present problem of major proportions that's grown exponentially since the end of the Cold War. In a moment, we'll hear about a hostage release today off the coast of Africa on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point off the coast of Somalia today in the Gulf of Aden. French troops captured six pirates after they released 30 hostages who'd been held on a tourist yacht. France claims no public money was used to pay ransom, but the boat's owners may have handed over some money. Daniel Sekulich formerly worked for the Canadian Broadcasting Company. He's now author of Ocean Titans, Journeys in the Search of the Soul of a Ship. He is also working on a book about modern-day piracy called Sea Terror. Daniel Sekulich, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
What more background can you give us on this incident today in the Gulf of Aden?
Essentially, what we have here is an ongoing case of piracy that's been going on in these waters for about the last 5 or 6 years in a major way. Piracy in Somalia is heavily overlooked. It's one of the two most dangerous places in the world to be caught as a mariner. Last year, there were about 154 individuals who were taken hostage by pirates off of Somalia. They have ranged from fishing boats to United Nations World Food Program, aid ships, tankers, freighters. The thing that's different about this is that they decided to try to go for, clearly, a passenger ship.
Now, apparently some kind of yacht with 30 hostages aboard. How long were they held?
The vessel was captured a week ago on the 4th, Friday the 4th of April. It was sailing about 80 miles northeast of Somalia, where the Gulf of Aden meets the Arabian Sea. There were no passengers aboard the vessel. It's a luxury cruise ship for passengers. At the time, it was just being sailed back from the Seychelles Islands by its crew.
So the crew were the hostages. Then, what about the ransom? And is that in generally what's involved here? Even with a UN food ship or a tanker?
It's part of the economy of the failed state of Somalia. Piracy is tied primarily to the warlords, and there's four main pirate groups that operate within what remains of Somalia. It's you could probably categorize it as a $10 to $20 million a year industry in terms of the income that it generates for warlords and their gangs.
How is it that the French were in this case able to capture the pirates?
This was an interesting situation. The six pirates had left the vessel Le Ponant and were ashore when, according to information I just received a couple of hours ago, they were seized by French commandos and then flown by helicopter out to the French aircraft carrier Jeanne d'Arc. There are some conflicting reports that I've been getting as to whether or not the pirates were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, had been tracked by the French commandos, or whether or not they actually may have been given up by the Somali warlords as a result of increasing pressure from the French and other international powers.
You have actually sailed through the waters that we are talking about, the Gulf of Aden, doing research for your new book. What did you see there?
You see one of the busiest waterways in the world. I mean, it's leading up to the Suez Canal, and as a result, it's a major sea lane of communication linking Europe and the Mediterranean with the Far East as well as the Middle East. The amount of vessel traffic you get there ranges from very large supertankers and container ships all the way down to dhows and fishing boats. Indeed, a lot of pleasure boaters who've sailed in that area have been familiar with the problem of piracy from both the Somali side as well as the Yemeni side of the Gulf of Aden. It's a very beautiful part of the world, but it's also a very dangerous part.
You said it's one of the two most dangerous places to sail. What's the other one?
The other one is on West Africa in the Gulf of Guinea, primarily off of Nigeria, where, again, the pirates and sea criminals have been attacking oil workers in the Delta region as well as on offshore platforms.
Now, when you're talking about the kind of traffic that you are and the possibility that it's at risk of piracy, particularly a supertanker, we're not talking Captain Hook.
No, we aren't. Piracy today is it's evolved into a much more sophisticated business. But it, fundamentally, it is about three things. It's about greed, lawlessness, and opportunity. It only can operate and flourish in areas where there is no security structure, no governing structure, or nor will to impose any legal concerns about piracy. So a prime example is an area like Somalia, which has no effective governing government, or in West Africa, where you have endemic corruption, which goes on, especially in the littoral regions around the Gulf of Guinea.
Well, are other countries, the U.S. included, willing to send their ships into these areas in order to try to police the situation?
That's actually a very difficult one, Warren, because there is a will which has been versed and spoken to by various powers, including Americans, including the French. However, it is usually only enacted when that threat really starts to affect their own resources, their own vessels, their own mariners.
So in this case, the French were there, the French military.
They were indeed. They were already having a naval presence in the region, and as such were able to adapt to that situation and react to it. But I think that there was probably, if it had been a Singaporean vessel or something perhaps from another part of Africa, the question is, would they have reacted in such a forceful way? Would the president of the French Republic had been making such a forceful acts? It's hard to say.
We have only a couple of seconds left, but has there been a time recently in Somalia when the warlords weren't in charge and piracy wasn't such a scourge?
Yes, they were. During the period when the Islamist Union was operating Somalia de facto, for about a 10-month period that ended at the early part of last year, they effectively reduced piracy to nil. And the analogy is when the Taliban first took over Afghanistan, they managed to almost take the poppy and opium production down to a much lower figure. Unfortunately, when they were displaced by the transitional federal government, piracy returned.
Okay, well, thank you very much. A lot of information about modern piracy. Daniel Sekulich, once again, he blogs at piratebook.blogspot.com. If you want to hear more from him, he's got a book coming out on sea terror, and his current book is already available, Ocean Titans, Journeys in Search of the Soul of a Ship. Thanks very much for joining us. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Dan Konecki, and Gary Scott. Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Cameron Ranziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family, I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.